Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is emergency show number two, so named because when we recorded this, I was busy.
Boy, were you.
So we rapidly put together a show here. Still a lot of interesting scientific information. Still the same witty banner. I can't keep a straight face with that. I'm sorry. Still the same dull conversation we always have every week, but we named it Emergency Show Number 2. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio. And to introduce our panel is me. And I will introduce, first of all...
Oh, my gosh.
Well, I'm trying to kind of class up the show, you know?
You can't.
I know I can't.
Have you ever heard the term lipstick on a pig?
From the University of Kentucky, the Physician Assistant Program, Assistant Professor Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
And I'm fortunately to introduce...
That other dude.
Would you like to introduce yourself?
No, that would not work. It's okay. Really fun listening to you.
From the University of Kentucky, Interim Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure, to tell you about Health Matters' magnificent presence on the web, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know there's two of them, right? We've got one for audio and one for talk. Right? Hey, whatever it is,
hey,
you want to go listen to it, go to WMKY.org. That's right, Morehead State Public Radio's website. Look there for through the menus, you'll find Health Matters. And there's a list of all the most recent shows. There's a summary, and but most importantly, there's a link to the audio. Go listen to the show. Go send the link to your friends. Send them to your enemies. We don't care who you send them to. We just say listen to them. Once you're done there, jump over to facebook.com/HM Radio Show, and you will find a fan page. There you can talk to us via your little keyboard. And you can certainly put in all the talk you would like, and we will listen to it. Again, we try to keep you up on what's going on. You'll see things come across the Tony's desk. You'll see things come across the news that we like to stick up there and just kind of probe you to think about a little bit. Sometimes they're medical, sometimes they're not. But
okay, Rick, I'm back if you want to stop stalling.
I was hoping you'd come back. Where did you go?
I don't know. I was just kind of making you suffer.
But this is the, let's make Tony laugh segment. But no, certainly interact with the show. Want to hear your show topics. We want to know what you think about the show. And this is your way to interact with us. Tony and I, we definitely get on there. We definitely will interact with the site. So you'd be surprised. We don't have handlers that do it for us. Right, Tony. You don't have a handler these days, do you?
No.
You had to think about that.
He had to think about it. Yeah.
I did.
Whoa. So anyway, you can find all that at facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
The sponsor for today's show, the Cancer Prevention and Early Detection Facts and Figures, published May 18th from the American Cancer Society, and I found one. I hesitate to use the word jaw-dropping. It turns out people are using the word jaw-dropping too much.
Isn't that two words?
You could hyphenate it.
Do you?
Sure.
So it could be two words or one
It could
word.
Be a one hyphenated
one
word. Jaw-dropping.
Jaw-dropping. It doesn't sound like
Here
a word to me, does it?
An exciting but not necessarily jaw-dropping facts from the Cancer Prevention Early Detection Facts and Figures from the American Cancer Society. They pointed out 20% of cancer cases diagnosed in the U.S. are preventable. Let me say that again. 20% of cancer cases diagnosed in the U.S. are preventable. Unfortunately, we don't prevent them. High-risk behaviors, eating the wrong foods, and that includes processed meats, that includes too much food, it also includes drinking alcohol, all those things will raise your risk of cancer. Not exercising, it turns out that's bad for your risk of cancer. Smoking cigarettes, everybody knows about that. And once again, drinking too much alcohol. And they also mentioned not using sun protection or following cancer screening recommendations. There are a few cancers we can screen for. A lot of them we can't, but there are many that we can reduce the incidence of by leading a healthy lifestyle. This means that we have cancer incidence rates, that's how often we find the cancer, and also cancer mortality rates that are much higher than they should be, according to the American Cancer Society. Some early detection and prevention measures have improved in recent years, but other cancer rates, the death rates, have either stabilized or worsened, according to Ann Goding-Sawyer, who's helped to author the report. The bottom line, she says, systemic solutions must be ramped up to further reduce the suffering and death from cancer. Now, here's the problem. What she's saying is you can't simply have people ask people to try harder, to be more disciplined, and to have more willpower and do the right thing with their diet, with their exercise, with smoking, alcohol, sunscreens, and prevention.
Putting shows together.
Thanks. I deserve that. So I'm not going to argue that, Rick. That you can have that point because you're absolutely right.
Hey, you're the one that brought it up.
I know.
I'm only exploiting
it. It is jaw-dropping how poorly I put this show together. But the point is we can reach a point where we cannot push willpower further. On the other hand, a lot of people feel uncomfortable when the government starts, we call it nudging. The government uses taxes, uses certain laws and regulations to affect our choice. Most Americans feel they need to be free to choose. And I'll just put in editorially, even though these companies can advertise to make you make bad choices, they do not feel that it is appropriate for the government to step in and try to help you make good choices. And you can see which side I am on this. I believe that that is a role. One of the roles of government is to keep people safe. And so I feel that that limitation would help. It would certainly lower our health care bills. But that's me being editorial. Here's some of the behaviors that they talked about. Number one, although only 15% of U.S. adults were smoking cigarettes in 2015, the report shows that smoking rates vary widely from state to state. 9% of adults smoke in Utah, 26% in Kentucky, three times the rate in Utah. And we really haven't changed that much since the 1970s. Now, here was what I thought was, I'll use the word, jaw-dropping. Kentuckians who had less than a high school degree, 46.7% of them smoked. Yes. College degree, 10.6%. Very close to Utah.
It's a big difference.
It's a huge difference. And I'm not sure our citizens realize this. 46.7% people that didn't get a high school degree in the state of Kentucky are smokers. 10.6 of college degree or greater people are smokers. There is this massive divide between the educational haves and have-nots in the state of Kentucky in terms of cigarette smoking, and it makes a huge difference in their life expectancy.
And getting a high school degree just should, I mean, there's no good reason why that shouldn't happen now.
But you guys
at least
gap,
not at that
though.
Rate.
You did have a gap. You said people who did not get a high school degree and then people who got a college degree. You missed
right.
The high school grads that were not college grads.
Right. There is a serial drop-off. The more education you get, the less likely you are to smoke. But in absolute numbers, if you don't go through high school. And you know, I mean, people who drop out of high school, there's not a plan for the future. There's not a kind of long-term thinking in a high school dropout. It's very short-term. And in that case, you could see how messages about eventual lung cancer, heart disease, and things like that cigarettes cause are not going to be very valid for a person who doesn't have a high school degree.
Don't you think it's somewhat interesting? I think today, if you look at the last, say, 20 years of maybe more than that, maybe closer to 40 years of dropouts compared to, you know, our parents or our grandparents' generation for dropouts, they dropped out for different reasons, right? They needed to work. They needed to, you know, run the farm, do whatever. But nowadays they fit your bill, Tony. I think I'm agreeing with you in that today we drop out for all the wrong reasons.
It may be rebellion. It may be a measure of despair. You look around and you say, it's not really worth getting an education. I don't see any benefit to it. It might still be pressures coming from family and,
could be,
and others.
Could be. There still could be a good percentage of that.
But I worry about the despair. And specifically, we've talked about deaths due to despair where people simply just stop taking care of themselves because what's the point?
Now, I mean, Kentucky still is one of the states that you still have your graduations tied to a driver's license, right? So if you drop out, you can't get your license until, what, 18 or something like that? I think there's still some impetus to try to keep you in school, and they try to use the driver's license as a way to do that. And I think it has done some good in the dropout rates, but still, sounds like these numbers, we need to get them to zero.
We do. Massive difference between, again, haves and have-not educationally. The more you tax cigarettes, the fewer people start smoking cigarettes and the lower your rate of smoking. The federal excise tax from federal government, $1 per pack, The state excise averages $1.69 per pack in 2017. But here in Kentucky, we're still down. Our state tax is 60 cents per pack. Hasn't changed since 2005. We are not the lowest anymore. Missouri is. They're 17 cents a pack. Back in 2005, we were a nickel a pack, and then we went to the 60 cents and haven't changed since then. It's helped. But again, we are well below the national average in terms of the amount of taxes we put on per pack. And those taxes disproportionately affect teenage smokers, disproportionately affect people who are about to start. People argue, well, gee, poor people pay that tax. That's true. And then poor people are more likely to die of lung cancer. And so anything we can do to lower smoking rates among poor people makes sense to me. That's our sponsor, the Cancer Prevention and Early Detection Facts and Figures. I've got some others, but I wanted to get that number out for people to realize this linkage between education and between smoking rates. I think it's an important one. It points to, if you're not in favor of raising taxes, if you're not in favor of an indoor smoking ban, you got to be in favor of education. This may also do our state a lot of good. Unfortunately, we're in the process of not raising taxes, not enacting a smoking ban, and cutting funding of education. So we have guaranteed a line of smokers for the foreseeable future with the direction we're heading in Kentucky. Next up, from Reuters Health, May 17, a moderate-intensity walking regimen may improve cognitive function in adults with mild vascular cognitive impairment. This is a small study. Weren't that many people, published in the British Journal of Sports Medicine, April 21st. We are going over some things that we intuitively know, and we've talked about before on this show, but there's been some additional information. 38 older adults, they had a vascular cognitive impairment. What that means is they had narrowing of their blood vessels, perhaps some strokes or mini strokes, perhaps just a poor blood supply to the brain. 38 older adults. One group followed an aerobic exercise program, 3 1-hour walking classes each week for 6 weeks. I wonder what a walking class, you know, you think there are tests or you have to take notes? Or you think you just get a group of people together and walk? Why is it a walking class?
They want to show you how to swing your arm so you look right.
Rick's got an answer for everything. I really like that.
It's for the people who have coordination issues.
Yeah,
you know,
so yeah, walking class.
All
right, try it again, Bill. Let's see if we can
just put one foot in front of the other.
Now, a little bit beside, but okay, you get the general idea. At any rate, 38 older adults. Two groups, one aerobic program with walking classes, the other usual care. Both groups given information about their problem and tips for eating a healthier diet. They did functional MRIs before and after, and it appeared that the brain activity improved in those who did the walking, and the brain activity did not change in the ones who didn't. So once again, another study indicating that walking is a great idea. So why are you sitting in front of your radio? You need to get up right now and take a walk. Take a hike, we say here at Health Matters, and come back for our second fractional portion on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the emergency show number two.
And boy, is it number two.
Well,
we go to the eighth grade every chance.
I know.
Come on. Even Shelly
like
can't keep us from going there.
She laughed. You got to say. I mean, Shelly's got a lot of class, but she still laughed when Rick said number two.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing like a good fart joke to get the segment started. Our sponsor for the second time.
I went the whole time without saying it.
I know. Cancer Prevention Early Detection Facts and Figures, published by the American Cancer Society online. And first of all, 15% of U.S. adults were smoking in 2015. Utah, 9%. Kentucky, 26%. But again, Kentuckians who had less than a high school degree, 46.7% of them smoked. And that means that the effects of smoking, including lung cancer, are going to preferentially affect those who do not have a high school degree. A very, very unfortunate situation. Number two, report confirms that 7 of 10, this I could not do the math on this, 7 of 10 U.S. adults are overweight or obese, including 35% of men and 40% of women. I hope I copied that down wrong. That makes no sense. It makes absolutely no sense. 7 of 10 adults are overweight or obese, including 35% of men and 40% of women. prevalence of obesity in men.
How can that be right?
Let's just say there's a lot of obese men and women out there. Is that fair? And men, it appears to have plateaued somewhat, but continues to increase in women. So the problem is obesity then leads to a variety of cancers, higher rates of variety of cancers. Prevalence ranged from 54% in District of Columbia to 71% in West Virginia, according to this report. And I'm really struggling with the numbers here. First of all, for many years, Louisiana, Mississippi have led the nation in obesity rates. West Virginia certainly has obesity, but they're busy smoking and don't have as much time to get obese. I don't like the way these numbers worked out. Prevalence of obesity among persons aged 12 to 19 tripled to 21% across all races, all ethnicities, for both sexes, and has not changed. And I'll do number three. About half of U.S. adults said they were meeting recommended levels of aerobic physical activity each week. Sounds like we need more walking classes.
Yes.
With the rates of physical activity markedly lower in high school students than in adults, only a quarter of teens reaching recommended levels.
Do you know how to walk, Tony? Do you need remedial walking classes?
You know, I do. What I need is something to remind me, to allow me time to walk.
Again, you have a Fitbit? They'll tell you to walk.
Yeah, they will.
Shelly, I didn't expect you to pile on this one.
Sorry.
Do you have a Fitbit, Shelly? I do.
I don't have it on right now, but I do. And it's just this is gentle vibration every hour. If I haven't got my steps in, just reminds me to get up and move.
Mine's not so gentle.
Rick's got the Iron Man Fitbit. It basically it slaps him.
Hey, look at my weight. It needs to.
And I think, no, and I'm looking at your job, which I think is the most important thing. Again,
that I sit down a lot?
Yeah, you are working, again, Rick is highly involved in the UK's technological infrastructure. That means a lot of time in front of a computer screen. That also means projects that you can't simply walk away from. And I'm somewhat in a similar position. It is very hard to get up when you're making progress.
Right. And right. So, I mean, I just love email so much that I have to sit in front of the computer all day and look at it.
No arguments.
You do too. You love it too, huh?
I do mine at night and still can't get going enough during the daytime.
You just need a Fitbit that'll smack you.
Yeah,
that's what you need.
I need a Fitbit Iron Man, which we'll split the profits on that one from you. I'm going to go one more. Number four, 29% reported eating two or more servings of fruit, 16% eating three or more servings of vegetables per day. About one in three high school students said they ate fruit two or more times a day. And then 15% reported consuming vegetables. Here's the problem. Why in the world, in the name of intelligent design, did anyone decide that vegetables prevented cancer? What a ridiculous...
They're keeping you from eating pork.
Well, I know, but my point is,
I
will tell you, if I designed the universe, vegetables would not be mandatory for good health.
Chocolate.
Yeah, I could think of so many things that I'd rather eat than vegetables.
But I mean, if you designed the earth, let's be honest, chocolate would grow on trees, not beans. Cocoa beans.
Yeah, you. It would be simpler. Once again, easier to get chocolate, which would be healthy.
And if you went up north, it'd all be ice cream.
Yeah. I need a chocolate-based life form. That's what I need. You remember the old Star Trek?
They had a
silicone-based life form. I need chocolate-based life form.
Yeah, there's a lot of jokes there. I'm going to stay away from
it. Silica-based. It wasn't silicone. As I think about it. Okay. We have a silicone-based life form. Here in the United States. But that's not what I was thinking. Please, will you people just allow me to express myself?
Boy, did we go to number two fast.
Okay. But there it is. People don't eat their vegetables. No one eats their vegetables.
Do you eat your vegetables?
No. As a matter of fact,
do you eat any at
all? I've gotten worse at vegetables.
I've been on Weight Watchers for a year, and so I do tend to eat an awful lot of vegetables. That's one thing I will say.
What's your favorite vegetable?
You know, there were years and years ago where I would have told you a different answer, but now I'd say it's probably a tie between green beans and broccoli.
Green beans, they've got to be fresh. I cannot do frozen or canned green beans. They just don't taste like anything. And I used to like green beans okay. I don't so much.
I ate enough broccoli to, you know.
Float a boat.
Well, I don't know if broccoli floats. Maybe it does. I don't know. But anyway, I eat a lot of broccoli.
I'm
probably about 4 days a week.
I would go with broccoli.
But you know, there was a time where it would have been something corn-based, right? Corn, peas, you know, baby peas. Those would probably have hit my.
Yeah.
But they're just those actually are some of the more sugary,
peas more sugary. Corn not a vegetable. Let me say it again: corn not a vegetable. Corn is a grain.
What planet did you grow up on?
Jean Jones's planet because she kept telling me every time I talked
Corn's
to her about
vegetable.
It.
I don't Corn. Care what anybody says. So is a potato.
No.
All right, Shelley. All right, if you have something other than green beans or broccoli.
Ooh, I don't know what my favorite is. I like a lot of vegetables. I like asparagus.
So you got somebody wishy-washy here, Tony.
Yeah.
She likes a lot of vegetables.
We need somebody who's, you know, committed. Not hyphenated.
To a certain vegetable? Well,
I
would say
she
if the vegetable is jaw-dropping,
you let
she's going to eat
with
it.
Me, you would have. You would give me a hard time, but you didn't.
No, I'm okay with Shelley because we work together, and it would be bad news if I crossed her. Next up, from the American... Well, I mean, let's face it. That conversation is going nowhere. I'm embarrassed that we talked this long about nothing at all.
About vegetables.
I thought we could provide our audience with some informative banter about vegetables, I was clearly wrong.
Doesn't the vegetable eating... isn't it somewhat dependent on how you prepare them? I mean, can't you ruin a vegetable?
Okay.
Like, you know,
absolutely ruin
fried
it.
Okra. But there you go. That's all
but here's the thing. I mean, 16% ate 3 or more servings of vegetables a day. So apparently, no matter – this is nationwide. It's even in Utah. They 16% say they ate 3 or more. What I'm saying is apparently, no matter how you prepare them, they're still vegetables. And so there's where your problems start.
But if you dip them in batter and deep fry them
– then they're not a vegetable anymore. You've killed the vegetable.
I don't know. It didn't seem that way.
Well, you don't deep fry stuff in Utah, so they don't even have that option.
I'm just saying, at least we still have the point of the fact that I do believe that preparation is kind of critical to a vegetable's
and what
value.
You're saying is cheese. Let's just substitute cheese for preparation. Prepare it any way you want to. Smother it in cheese, you probably can choke it down.
Are you going to now assault cheese? I don't like you.
All right, from the American Urological Association, I can't take this anywhere, the 2017 annual meeting, and here is some important news for those who bicycle. According to, this is Medscape coverage of this.
Describe
I did
bicycle.
Not attend it.
Like 10-speed, long range, or?
Yeah. I'll get to the study in a minute, but here is the bottom line. Here's the punchline we're going to be talking about. Bicycling does not have significant deleterious effects on either sexual or urinary function in men or women. Two large population-based surveys. These are not, we didn't randomize people to ride a bike or not ride a bike, but they did surveys presented at the American Urological Association annual meeting May 19th of 2017. A guy named Mohanad Awad, who used Facebook ads to recruit English-speaking sporting clubs around the world to recruit casual and serious cyclists. So you ask yourself, what kind of bicycles? Apparently a lot of different kinds. The men were asked about physical activity, completed the questionnaires. Women were asked about, they completed something called female sexual function inventory, and international men did international prostate symptom score for urinary symptoms. Participants are also asked about other things like cycling, running, road characteristics, history of kidney infections, and saddle sores. 46% of these 8,000 men were athletes. Half the 5,000 women. If you cycle for at least 2 years, ride for at least 3 times a week, ride at least 25 miles a day. So that's pretty serious bicycling.
Right.
2 years, 3 times a week, 25 miles a day. What happens? Well, turns out some degree of numbness, mostly in the male diaper area, was reported by 44% of cyclists. Let me say that again. 44% of cyclists reported numbness of their manly parts. It lasted more than a day in only 2% of the men, most often less than an hour. Does that make you feel reassured?
No.
Numbness lasting more than a day in the manly area. Saddle sores.
Makes me not want to buy
a third of men, and 46% of those were basically in between the legs. Here's what you do, do you not know this? Stand on the pedals while cycling. Adjust the height of the handlebars. And that'll change the numbness and so forth. For women, sexual and urinary function, no difference between cyclists and non-cyclists. There was a trend toward more urinary infections in cyclists. Some numbness reported by 39% of women lasted more than a day and 2% again, less than an hour mostly. Saddle sores, 40% of women cyclists, 54% of those in the middle of the diaper area in between the legs. And so these data are reassuring, says a cyclist. I don't know. Numbness lasting more than a day still, I don't expect that as a part of my exercise program. You can tell I don't cycle 25 miles a day, 3 days.
You don't
a week.
Cycle 25 a year.
No, I in fact do not. I am not a cyclist.
I at least take a leisure bicycle, and when I'm on vacation, we ride around on an island But I would not say in any way, shape, or form that I'm a cyclist. It's pretty – that would be some one of the worst stretches I've ever said.
You know, we had a cardiologist, a cautious man, a physician who came over from Lexington and saw patients in Moorhead for years. And he fractured his collarbone in a bicycle wreck. And this is a guy who doesn't go fast, not a daredevil at all. And I started at that point, I started noticing how many people sustained fractured collarbones and other fractures from cycling, and I was disturbed by it. It's common. I won't say I don't have numbers on it, but it worried me that my exercise program led to broken bones. So I do stationary bicycling. I do. It's recumbent, though, so I don't get numb. And I only outdoor bike, again, in places where traffic is very restricted, and I do it on a very limited basis, Rick. And that's me just being cautious. I just don't want to break my collarbone. May 22nd, this was from Harvard Health Publications, a guy named Gregory Kerfman, and he's reported on an article published in the AMA Journal of Internal Medicine. And the question is asked, and Shelley, how many times have we seen this? Should people older than age 75 receive statin therapy for their cholesterol?
No.
Yeah,
no.
You are correct. No, they should not. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force says there is insufficient evidence to draw a conclusion about benefits and harms in this risk group. But still, even so, these drugs, these are drugs like Lipitor, Crestor, Mevacor, let's see, Pravastatin, which is Pravacol, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Still commonly prescribed to people over age 75 years. And actually, the prevalence is increasing. In people over age 79, statin use for preventing heart disease in people who didn't have heart disease jumped from 8% in 2000 to 34% in 2011. So these statins, they're good drugs, but they are not being tested on people, extremely old people. So this is what they published in the AMA Journal of Internal Medicine. They looked at several large-scale trials, and they separated out people who were over age 75. And taken together, the analysis of these older people said, well, there might be a modest benefit of statins on heart problems, but no significant benefit on all-cause mortality. That is, you would die of something else, so the benefits on the heart really didn't make any difference. The latest study looked at a large lipid-lowering trial, looked at everybody over 65 years old. If you look at people 65 to 74, the mortality rate was 15.5% in pravastatin group, 14% in the usual control group. So a percentage difference, slightly better at age 65 to 74. But once you get to 75, there was actually an increase in mortality in the pravastatin group, 24% compared with 18% mortality in the care that people that didn't get the pravastatin. These statins, they have been generally felt to be safe. They do not appear to have significant effects on the liver. They can cause increased muscle pains, muscle weakness, and some damage to the muscles in people who take them. And particularly in older people, that may make a big difference. They may increase your risk of falls, and that may outdo any cardiac benefits you get. We have, Shelley and I, well, we've made a living trying to get people. That lady we saw, 99,
mm-hmm.
Was on a statin. And we'd taken her off of it. I think she got put back on it.
Yes. Uh-huh. yep.
We do house visits, and we took her off. She went to see, I think, her heart doctor, put her back on. We're taking her off again, trying to protect her from the ill effects of these statins at age 99. There is no clear benefit for statins. Now, again, let's talk about this. This is primary prevention. You've not had a heart attack. You've not had a stroke. You're an older person. Can we prevent you from having your first heart attack and stroke by starting you or keeping you on statins after age 75? The answer is no. And apparently, and this is my problem, is that the all-cause mortality, you look at deaths due to cancer, falls, strokes, and other conditions, the overall mortality rate is higher if we do start you on a statin, according to this one study, and without any proof of benefit for that particular group. Now, if you have dangerous problem with your heart in the first place, you've got to talk to your doctor. You've got to be certain you want to come off these medicines. I believe at age 99, there are very few reasons why I would keep a person on a statin. My concern is our 99-year-old lady was having trouble getting out of bed, and we know these things cause muscle weakness. And so even
she had
if
fallen.
It, yeah, she had had falls, and even if we were keeping her alive, we were not. I was concerned we were having a bad impact on her quality of life. And at age 99, that for me, for my patients, becomes a very important thing. What mm-hmm. kind of joy can they have? And it's much harder to have joy if you can't get out of bed, in my opinion. So we'll leave that. I would just say, you know, they get our old. I'm concerned, especially in the patient population that I'm seeing, that there are a lot of older patients who, in fact, are on medications that were designed for people that are 30 or 40 years younger than them, tested on people 30 or 40 years younger than them, and we have no idea the effects. And I think we are causing some harm in that patient population. And certainly I do not like to see a 99-year-old woman on a statin medicine to try to get her cholesterol down. Let's continue on with that. Rick has accused me of being old, so I'm going to come back with more older people stuff.
Tony, it's not an accusation. There's a cutoff, and you meet it.
That was really harsh. I find myself liking you a lot.
I didn't say which side of the cutoff you were on. What'd you think I meant?
You said I meet it.
Well, yeah.
What do you think that means?
You're looking at it right in the face.
That's a pretty definite statement. You meet it. What Rick is doing, which he often does, is he looks at the clock. And
right.
when he sees the time winding down in this segment,
he'll do anything to keep you talking. Absolutely anything.
He decides he's going to insult me because he figures I can't start
It takes you a while to retaliate, too. So you burn 15 or 16 seconds trying to retaliate.
Yeah. Listen, we're going to take a break now. I'm going to think of a really sharp retort.
What did you say?
And we're going to come back in our third and final fractional portion. I am going to roast Rick. Right there as we start the third and final fraction.
Okay, old guy.
Can't wait to see this. Stay tuned on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the emergency show number
Aren't you
two.
The old Dr. Weaver?
Listen, Mr. Poopy Pants.
Hey, my old friend.
You can keep it to yourself,
my
man.
Old friend down on the end.
Death. Don't go swimming with Rick, I tell you that much. I think he's had enough.
Okay, I'll go easy on you this.
Our sponsor.
It's fun to let him laugh. It's fun to hear him laugh.
Cancer prevention, early detection, facts and figures from the American Cancer Society reminding you, number one, 15% of U.S. adults were smoking in 2015, but the rate varied highly. Between 9% in Utah, which is always the nation's low, 26% in Kentucky, which has been first or second in the nation for my entire adult life. But in the state of Kentucky, if you have less than a high school degree, the rate of smoking is 46.7%.
My guess that's been that way your whole life, but, you know, I guess
yeah.
we're going to leave out that part where you weren't an adult.
Now I've got to go think of another sharp retort because I don't want to use my last one. So stay tuned next week as I respond to Rick's outrageous comments.
Tony, your battle of wits. It's a battle of wits.
I just hate to say these things. 7 or 10 U.S. adults are overweight, obese, including 35% of men and 40% of women, and the rest of them make up the difference.
It's fuzzy math. Right?
It is. Don't worry about that. Just. There's lots of obese people. We need to fix that. In 2015, half of U.S. adults said they were meeting the recommended levels of aerobic physical activity each week, and I doubt that. Can I say that? But teens, only 27%. I believe they're telling the truth, but at any rate, low rates there. 29% eating 2 or more servings of fruit, 16% 3 or more servings of vegetables per day. That's because vegetables are horrible, and it's hard to fix vegetables in any way that would be palatable. And I'm sticking to that. I'm going to make that statement here.
I'm telling you, you put enough cheese on any of the vegetables, it's good.
I know. And the good news is you can eat cheese now because we're recognizing the differences. If we don't use trans unsaturated fats, saturated fats are not the big deal that we once thought. So if you can keep the calories down, you can smother them in cheese, and you can at least choke down some broccoli or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's my strategy.
And cauliflower. Cauliflower has to have something. You can't eat cauliflower.
That's weird.
It is just bland.
Okay. My wife, I would just tell you, she found this recipe where you could make basically something like rice that looked like rice out of cauliflower.
Well, you know why? Because neither of them have any flavor.
I know. So she gave me a nice serving of what looked like rice, but was actually cauliflower.
Did you like it?
No. It was, the thing is, rice has a certain texture. And so you get a spoonful of rice, you're eating, or a forkful of rice, you're eating rice. So, this stuff was weird. So, just didn't taste like earth food.
But you can take cauliflower, you can hit it with a blender, hit it with a mixer really hard and get it, nice, and then add a little bit of butter and a little bit of milk like you would mashed potatoes.
Yeah,
and
that's
it
good.
It almost tastes like mashed potatoes.
I like that
a lot. Yeah.
Have you tried the rice?
Yeah, you can also make like gluten-free pizza crust out of cauliflower as well.
But why?
Some of us don't have the metabolism of you, like, your little hummingbird metabolism.
I don't know what that means. A hummingbird is beating its wings.
I'm just saying, Tony.
That's not a metabolism. That's just a bird that's desperately trying to stay in the air.
I'm pretty sure they're burning a lot of calories, right?
Hummingbird. I'm sorry. I can't allow that. Number five, 28% of adults were consuming excess amounts of alcohol. And again, this leads to higher rates of cancer. As a matter of fact, the latest things I've seen on breast cancer, even a single drink can raise your risk of breast cancer. Now, we talk about drinks being good for your heart, but I believe that the cancer risk is really going to markedly attenuate that, if not just wipe it out completely. Despite public health campaigns urging us to protect ourselves from the sun, use sunscreen, 60% of girls, 52% of boys in high school reported having a sunburn in the past year. You cannot have a sunburn as a teenager. This is a bad idea. This is a mistake happening. Only 13% of adults wear long-sleeve shirts. I guess that's outdoors in the summer. I don't know. 15% said they wear a wide brim hat when outside for more than an hour. I've got a wide brim hat.
Do you wear it?
Not when I'm in the shade. I try to stay in the shade. That's my solution.
And you're successful all the time?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I know if I'm going to spend a lot of time out, if I'm mowing the pasture fields or something like that, I got to have the hat. That's all there is to it. Indoor tanning continues to be popular, particularly in the Midwest. 6% of people, 6% of women, 2% of men in the Midwest. Highest rates of indoor tanning still seen in teenage girls. And once again, putting them at risk for sunburns. And number seven, and I'll stop there, human papillomavirus vaccine rates. That's the HPV vaccine. They lag behind those of other vaccines. Only half of girls and only about a third of boys have completed two or more doses in 2015. We still got some work to do there. Again, that vaccine, very effective at preventing cervical cancer and other cancerous lesions in the diaper area. Now, before Rick derailed me last time, we were talking about older people, and I've got a couple of things that older people need to hear. I don't know if they need to hear them or not, but I need to talk about older people, so I'm going to do that because one day I are one. Nearly one in five Medicare beneficiaries. These are people over age 65 who undergo a LAP band, a laparoscopic gastric banding. They end up needing an additional band-related surgery. Nearly one in five who get the LAP band need additional related surgery. This is a study in JAMA Surgery. They just look back on people. They use Medicare claims data. 25,000 adults who had Medicare underwent gastric band surgery between 2006 and 2013. So you're looking at seven, if you include both years, you're looking at 8 years of data. 25,000 Medicare beneficiaries had a LAP band. During an average follow-up of 4.5 years, 19% underwent reoperations, either taking the band out, replaced the band, switched to a different procedure, and four reoperations per patient. Reoperation rates varied across hospital referral regions, 5% up to 96%. Depending on the hospital. Medicare payments, $12,000 for each initial band placement, $20,000 for each reoperation. These findings suggest that payers should reconsider the coverage for the gastric band device, but they did have a commentator saying, I feel that it still has a role because, you're looking at one in five. What about the four in five? How do they do on weight loss? How do they do in overall health measures? Many patients do well for a long period, according to this commentator. You know, what we've learned is the lap band, the initial procedure, is less invasive than other forms of surgery. You can do it, again, laparoscopically. You place a band around the stomach, which constricts the size of the stomach. The band tends to move. As you tend to eat, the constriction tends to get less, and other complications come up. So there is a higher rate of reoperation. These reoperations are pretty much just a part of the overall procedure of gastric banding. We are much more likely to do gastric sleeve resection, which means basically taking out the wide part of the stomach, leaving a tube going from your esophagus and swallowing tube into your intestines rather than a pouch, which is what the stomach looks like. But with gastric banding, again, you get a easier recovery up front, but you do get more repeat procedures and a little bit less effectiveness. And that is just particularly true for Medicare beneficiaries.
It'd be nice to know what's different about that 20%. Why is it that they have to have the reoperation?
Right. Do they have something different about their anatomy, their eating habits? What fuels that? And to be honest with you, this is administrative data, so they just simply they were able to capture Medicare payments for reoperation. And that's the spreadsheet, that's the financial data, not anything about reason for it. So we don't know why that happens, but I think universally people will tell you that a lap band has a higher reoperation rate than other forms of obesity surgery. And this more or less, confirmed that. The next one, I had already talked to Shelley about this one. This was from Arthritis Care and Research, a group led by Grace Lowe of Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. In older people who had no symptoms, if you report creaky knees, they call it knee crepitus, but essentially creaky knees, you were more likely to have osteoarthritis of the knees. More than 75% of cases occurred in individuals who had pre-existing X-ray changes but didn't have any symptoms. But they had creaky knees, and they wound up going ahead to have arthritis. So, you know, I knew young people who could crack their spine. Lots of people can pop their knuckles. Mm-hmm. I have several grating joints as I've gotten older. Shoulders and neck in a quiet room. I can turn my head or rotate my arms, and I can hear myself. I do not yet have creaky knees. Shelly and Rick are younger than me. Hopefully neither one of you has creaky knees. Do your knees make noise when you stand up?
Not unless the day before I played racquetball. No, they don't. Not really.
Sounds of popping, grinding, clicking, grating, or cracking in and around the knee may indicate arthritis in as little as a year, according to them.
But now, Tony, are you creaky in the morning? Like, as everything is kind of like loosening up and after a good night's sleep? Does it take you a few minutes? Because I notice when I come down our stairs in the morning,
you make noise?
I do. Things are popping, and I mean, there's things that are creaking, but, you know, it's only
not
that
your knees.
One. No, it's not the knees.
I would say, feet.
Feet,
definitely
and ankle, yeah.
Make a lot of noise. You got to get your Fitbit to record some of your noises since it's so
It doesn't
powerful.
Record audio. It only records movement.
Wow. Rick went for the cheap Fitbit.
At least I have one.
Put it on your ankle.
There you go. Then it looked like I'm not allowed to leave my house.
Yeah. Next week, I think rather than writing a script, we're just going to broadcast Rick's knees.
We didn't write one this time.
Rick walk down the stairs, and we'll broadcast his knees, and you'll get, it's sort of like, you know, the fireplace at the Christmas time. Rick's knees during the summer, kind of a relaxing sound of Rick's knees popping and crackling on the radio.
No, we never said it was knees. That's what started the jokes.
Listen, jokes are not about truth. They're about perception. All right, what they had here, they had 3,500 participants in 2004 and 11,000 observations, 42% male. Average age was 61, and that's even older than me. Body mass index of 28, so they were overweight but not obese. 636 cases of arthritis. Largest in the first observation period within 12 months. So it happened pretty fast. If you had cracking and popping your knees, they either said never, rarely, sometimes, often, and always. If you have it rarely, your odds of getting arthritis were 1.5, sometimes 1.8, often 2.2, and if you always have cracking, popping the knees, a 3 times risk of getting arthritis. And if you look pretty much at any time course during the 4.5 years or 5 years of follow-up that they did, same thing. The popping and cracking scores correlated with the arthritis scores. Can apply this to other joints. Don't know about people who were younger. Average age, again, 61. A lot of people ask about joints popping. You always have somebody come in the clinic and say, what does it mean this joint pops?
What do you tell them?
In most cases, I tell them it doesn't mean much of anything, because I still remember I had one of the girls I coached back when I was coaching soccer many, many, many years ago when my kids were young. She could kind of shrug her shoulders, and you could hear her entire spine crackle.
Wow.
And I have now followed this particular patient, who's not really a patient, throughout her adult life, and she is okay. No spine problems that I'm able to identify, knowing her as an adult. So that's what I usually say. Do you have that, Shelly? What do you tell people when their joints pop?
Well, if they're younger, the same thing you do. If they're older, then I talk to them about, you know, risk for arthritis.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. Let's face it, if you're younger, odds are probably it's fine no matter what. Right? I mean, you don't really have to worry about that.
Mm-mm.
Okay. Rick, I've been talking about odds and ends, and so now it's time to get serious about technology. Sarasota Memorial Hospital.
And I got a whole 2 minutes.
Sure. This is the first hospital in the United States as of May 21st. To deploy an indoor wayfinding app that uses geomagnetic positioning technology. The problem is you lose your GPS signals on indoor areas. So what they do, they use digital compasses and sensors inside smartphones and a magnetic footprint found inside buildings to help people pinpoint their exact locations. You download the app, you need to get to room 313 in Tower F, and your phone will locate you and give you a bunch of blue dots to tell you how to walk to Tower F and go to room 313.
Great. You trust it?
Well, you know, they didn't say whether it worked. They just said that they did it.
Sure. I mean, and you know, there are beaconing systems today that you can buy that put Bluetooth or RFID or all kinds of various, you know, methods that you can geolocate or figure out how to do what we call wayfinding, which is, you know, helping people find their way. There's lots of technologies that do that, but you have to think it. You know, it has to be a designed process, and it's not. I've not seen a technology today that requires nothing installed.
So you got to put magnets in the buildings, or
magnets, or you have to, in the app itself, has to have detailed maps to deal with the accelerometer, and you know, so you can tell which way the thing is moving and where it goes, and kind of keep track of where it is on a legitimate floor plan. So yeah, it's I've not seen anything that's really done. Now the beaconing systems are great. They work well. They can pinpoint your location within a few feet for, you know, not a lot of cost.
Mm-hmm. I remember in the old University of Kentucky Chandler Hospital, they had a rainbow of colored lines that started in the front lobby,
right,
and went to different sections of the hospital, right, and you just followed the red line until it ran out.
Yeah, you're seeing a lot of the wireless access point companies are starting to put either beacons along with their – you can get it embedded into the wireless access point, or you can buy actual battery-powered beacons that, you know, every 3 or 4 years you got to pull the beacon down and change the battery in it. But there's definite technology you can do for – what the term you're looking for is wayfinding.
Yeah, and I'm assuming the UK is not going to be installing those until you see something more reliable than what we got.
Well, we don't have any. I mean, the stuff that you buy today is reliable. I'm saying I've not seen anything that doesn't have an installed device that's reliable. You just said that it doesn't use anything. It basically uses, you know, the open air and magnetic image. You know, it's kind of the magnetic feel of the room, and that's it. Just won't. I've not seen anything like that works.
Do you think you can wayfind us off the air?
Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Sean Delaney, and to Eric Bilber, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org. Or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
Health Matters is used with a proper diet and exercise, and possibly with other radio shows, to control high blood sugar. Nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, weakness, or a metallic taste in the mouth may occur. If any of these effects persist or worsen, tell your doctor or pharmacist promptly.
Health Matters can cause a serious and sometimes fatal condition called lactic acidosis. Stop listening to Health Matters and get medical help right away if you develop any of the following symptoms of lactic acidosis: unusual tiredness, dizziness, severe drowsiness, chills, cold skin, muscle pain, slow heartbeat, stomach pain with nausea, vomiting, or diarrhea.
Read the patient information leaflet, if available, from your pharmacist before you start listening to our show and each time there is a break. If you have any questions, consult your doctor or pharmacist.
Tell your doctor immediately if any of these conditions occur, or if you notice a big change in your overall health. You may need to stop listening to our show temporarily. The elderly are also at higher risk, especially those older than 80 years old who do not have kidney tests.
Health Matters does not usually cause low blood sugar. However, low blood sugar may occur if our show is prescribed with other anti-diabetic radio shows.
Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.